I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, teenagers are getting ready for the summer, but for many of them, it is not all sun and fun. There have been gloomy numbers on the jobs front. So we're going to speak with Hilda Solis. She is the Secretary of Labor, and she'll tell us about how the administration is trying to help more teens get that coveted summer job. But first, we go to the other end of the education spectrum, where you think those job concerns might not be a big issue. Now, we've talked on this program a number of times about how more Americans have been relying on food stamps and unemployment benefits to get by. But you might be surprised to learn, as we were, frankly, about one group that has taken a particularly hard hit. The number of people with PhDs who have had to apply for food stamps or other government assistance like unemployment more than tripled between 2007 and 2010, according to a recent study. The Chronicle of Higher Education recently reported on this, and we wanted to know more, so we've called upon staff reporter Stacy Patton. Also with us is Tony Yang. He received his PhD from the University of California, Riverside, 3 years ago. He's worked off and on as a history lecturer since then, but he has also relied on unemployment benefits and food stamps to get by. I welcome you both. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Stacy Patton, let me start with you. Why are people with doctorates getting hit so hard?
Well, I guess there's a bit of backstory to answer your question. When I started covering graduate students for the Chronicle, I noticed that there's a lot of overlap between graduate students and adjuncts. These are contingent faculty who are working on contracts. And there's been a major shift in the past 30 years in universities' reliance on contingent faculty. They work part-time, they don't have health benefits, they can be fired or not have their contracts renewed. And so it's a much cheaper way. It's a cost-cutting measure for many universities. But what we continue to do in graduate schools is to encourage people to get master's degrees and PhDs. And the economy has taken such a hit, and so has higher ed has taken such a hit, that they do their work and then come out and not have, you know, opportunities for jobs.
Well, let's bring Professor Yang in here, because he's kind of a real-world example of exactly what you're talking about. Professor Yang, you graduated in 2009, and you told Stacy that the first thing you did was file for unemployment. And then for the past 3 years, you have worked, but as I understand it, you've never been able to put enough hours together to earn a living wage. Does that about sum it up?
That about sums it up. I think one of the bravest things to do is to try to graduate into the Great Recession. But it's an extremely difficult job market, and you're always constantly hustling to try to get another job or an appointment, and you don't turn them down even though you probably should. And it's an experience I think a lot of us have shared, those of us who are just coming out onto the job market right now, particularly in higher education.
At your peak, your best year of earnings, do you mind if I ask, what was it?
It was about $32,000.
$32,000 in your best year. Yeah. What about your worst?
Ten. Yeah.
So you were making as much as a nanny, basically.
Probably.
A full-time nanny in an urban area who's actually making what they're supposed to make, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Professor V.P. Franklin, he teaches here, and he was teaching at Harvard on one of these renewable contracts years ago. And someone at Harvard, one of the tenured faculty members, told him, well, but you have prestige at teaching at Harvard. His response was, and this is my response to my students, I can't eat prestige. Mm. You know, I have the prestige of holding a PhD, but that ain't paying the bills.
We're talking about the rising number of people with advanced degrees who are relying on food stamps and other government assistance to get by. I'm speaking with Tony Yang. He holds a doctorate and has used government benefits to make ends meet. He's currently unemployed. Stacy Patton is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about this recently. Stacy Patton, you talked about the fact that a number of states have cut their higher education budgets. Are the universities who are using what you call contingent faculty, what I think a lot of people call adjuncts, explicitly as a cost-saving measure, or is there some other cover story, if I can use that phrase?
It depends on who you ask. Certainly, many of the adjuncts would say that it is definitely cost-cutting measure. And so the universities will say, well, our budgets are being cut. We would love to hire more full-time faculty, but we just can't.
Did you have a hard time getting people to talk about this? And I guess the other question I was asking is, did people feel a sense of shame about this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would hear graduate students and adjuncts say, well, I make so little bit of money that I actually qualify for food stamps. And so what I did was I got in touch with many organizations such as the New Faculty Majority, Coalition of Academic Workers, and other unions, and talked with their leaders and said, hey, have you heard of people who are actually on government assistance? And they all said yes. The people just kept emailing me, telling me their stories. And then it was a matter of, well, who wants to go on record? And definitely there was a lot of shame. There were a lot of people who wanted to remain anonymous, because you go to graduate school, you get a master's degree, you get a PhD. It's a hard thing to embrace that you're also now on welfare.
Mm-hmm. Professor Yang, do you mind if I ask you, was it a difficult decision for you to decide to go public about your circumstances and to be interviewed and to use your name?
You know, I don't have a problem with that. It might just be my personality. It might have been really the fact that I grew up on food stamps and grew up poor. And I really don't have a problem with it. And I'm not particularly judgmental about it. My parents, on the other hand, are probably a little bit ashamed. I've had my mom tell me on more than one occasion I got the wrong PhD, because mine's in history and not in computer science. And because I could somehow be gainfully employed. There's this perception out there that if you have a PhD, you remarkably walk into a $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year job. And that's just simply not the case.
Well, let me just focus on something you just talked about here, which is your choice of area of study, your particular academic discipline. There were some comments I noted on Stacey, on the site about this. There were a number of people who offered their own stories, but there were also a lot of people who were very unsympathetic, Professor Yang. They kind of took the same position as your mom, which is, you're smart. Why couldn't you figure out that this was going to be a soft job market? And I apologize if that sounds hurtful, but I did want to ask if that factored into your decision-making at all.
To some extent, it did. I mean, that's why I'm doing economic history and not just, you know, a cultural study of the New Left, not to deride those sort of studies, but it did guide it at some level for that. On the other hand, I think that there's a specific problem with justifying the lack of available full-time teaching positions by sort of saying, well, you know, the market dictates what the market dictates. In a larger political sort of aspect, we teach civics and how the government functions. And when you slash budgets, particularly on the humanities side, you're saying that it's not as important as the engineering disciplines or as in the biochemistry disciplines. And that has very deep effects. And something I tell my students, that the result of some of this horrible political divisiveness or people not understanding political ideology or rhetoric can be directly traced to the lack of underfunding, you know, these basic civics classes.
Stacey Patton, have you found that there are certain disciplines where graduates or people who hold these degrees are more likely to be underemployed than others? Does it tend to be concentrated in the humanities?
From what I'm hearing, yes. I did a short survey that accompanied the piece and took note of the top fields in which graduate degree holders were also food stamp recipients. And they, I believe the top were English and history and communications or something like that. But there were people who were also in biology and in the sciences. I saw maybe two respondents who were in the math.
And finally, you mentioned that there's a vast gap between people who have kind of tenured positions, administrators, and people like Professor Yang who are just starting their careers. Is this seen as a problem in the academy?
Oh, I definitely. I hear all the time from adjunct advocacy groups. I hear it from the adjuncts themselves. I think graduate students are also very anxious. The level of transparency about student outcomes and the availability of jobs and what we're training students to actually do to meet the market demands is starting to be a serious conversation. In terms of people with master's and PhDs on government assistance, I think has come as a shock to many people. I too was shocked by the numbers. It's about 1% of master's degree holders and 1% of PhD degree holders who were on government assistance. So someone might come along and say, oh, that's such a small number. But what's frightening to me is that the numbers more than doubled in a 3-year period. And so one has to wonder, is this trend going to continue to increase if the government's data has actually captured a full picture of people who have these degrees, who are also in graduate school, and also relying on food stamps or are even eligible for government assistance.
Professor Yang, I have to ask, if you had to do it all over again, do you think you would still pursue your doctorate in this area, in your discipline?
I would. I think we're always worth pursuing intellectual pursuits. It's always worth it to sort of gain a better understanding of the world. And let's face it, you know, if you have a PhD, you're in a subset of the population that has a tremendous amount of skill and determination to actually get that degree. I think at the end of the day, your skills will translate to something. It just might not be in our field. And that's something that's a little bit sad because we're losing a lot of potential and a lot of expertise. But I think it certainly is worth it, at least from an intellectual standpoint, to go ahead and pursue your interest and curiosity and find out what, you know, your subject matter is all about.
Tony Yang has a PhD in history from the University of California, Riverside, and he was kind enough to join us from that campus. Stacey Patton is a staff reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she wrote about the number of people with advanced degrees and graduate students who are relying on government benefits, including food stamps, to make ends meet, and she joined us from Baltimore. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle.
On a Tuesday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. If you were feeling bleary-eyed when your alarm went off or when you started hearing our voices this morning, there's a good chance you're not finely attuned to your body's own sleep cues. A new study by German sleep researchers finds that in our 24/7 culture, many of us are paying the price for ignoring our internal biological clocks. And as NPR's Allison Aubrey reports, the consequences can be measured in our expanding waistlines.
We all know what jet lag is. You fly across time zones, your internal clock gets confused, and all you want to do is eat and sleep at all the wrong times. But think about this. What if the pace and schedule of our everyday lives is leading to the same sort of effect? This is the theory of German sleep researcher Till Ronneberg.
The idea came from sleep logs. We've got hundreds of sleep logs or even thousands of sleep logs.
Ronneberg says when he analyzed people's sleep and wake times, some interesting patterns emerged. People's schedules during the work week were so different from their routines on the weekend that it was as if they had switched time zones. For example, waking up very early Monday to Thursday and more or less going to bed at a regular time, then on Friday, still waking up early but staying up or staying out with friends until the wee hours of Saturday morning.
What these look like if the people would fly on a Friday evening many time zones to the west.
So Saturday morning, you wake up 3 to 4 hours later than usual, you eat later, maybe brunch at noon instead of breakfast at 7, and you live by a different clock the whole weekend.
We realized that this was a jet lag-like situation.
He's coined the phrase social jet lag, where sleep isn't governed by your biological clock, but by your social calendar. I tried out the theory on a group of 20-something professionals who were hanging out together here in Washington, D.C.
That definitely applies to my life.
Friends Katie Gambale and Amanda Zoitlin say their weekend schedules are completely different.
Well, we don't have to wake up as early because we don't have work, so we'll go out even later and then sleep really late.
Katie Gambale says it does seem a little crazy.
We were actually just discussing this. A lot of the social norms right now involve like going out at a really late hour, and nobody actually goes out until 11 or 12 at night, which I think is bizarre. But if you don't do it, you're not going to be out when your friends are out. So it's kind of the culture now to be a night owl.
For now, this schedule works. This gang of friends is fit and vivacious and say they feel they get enough sleep. But Ronneberg says in the long term, living against our biological clocks can catch up with us.
People who suffer from social jet lag hardly ever sleep one night that is according to their sleep need.
And Ronneberg's research finds that this social jet lag is linked to higher body weight.
The larger the discrepancy between the social time and what your biological clock tells you to do, the more likely it is that you are obese.
Whether disrupting your body clock has an effect on your weight over and above the fact it reduces the amount of sleep you get is unclear, but there's certainly a whole body of evidence linking too little sleep to weight problems.
As sleep researchers, we do believe that there's an intimate relationship between insufficient sleep and the drive to store fat.
Physician Helene M. Selim directs the Center for Sleep and Wake Disorders in Chevy Chase, Maryland. She says this connection has been documented in shift workers, such as nurses, in teenagers, and in mothers of infants. In some cases, people do eat more when their schedules are wacky. But M. Selim says it's also possible that something more primitive is at play here.
Unfortunately, we have caveman's hardcore wiring, and insufficient sleep in primitive times was read by the body as danger, store fat.
Which was our ancestors' best chance of surviving whatever calamity was keeping them awake. And when this happens, it seems a hormonal shift takes place, so that instead of burning calories quickly, the body tries to store them. Experts say this may be just one of several complicated mechanisms linking sleep and weight. But Dr. Matthew Gilman of Harvard Medical School, who directs an obesity prevention program, says the important take-home message is this.
We know if people sleep less, even starting in infants, that leads to greater risk of obesity.
Gilman acknowledges that this sleep longer, sleep better message is easier to preach than to live by.
And I guess I'm a big offender because I got up this morning at 4 o'clock to make a 6 o'clock flight to Washington, D.C.
But in our crazy go-go society, it may be wise to start paying more attention to that internal clock. You definitely have one, and it does not sound like this. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week, we're taking a closer look at the natural gas industry and its impact on human health and the environment. In just under a decade, some 200,000 gas wells have been drilled in the U.S. The boom is largely the product of an engineering technique that allows drillers to tap gas reserves that were once unreachable. The technique is called hydraulic fracturing.
Fracking has generated much-needed jobs, about 600,000 of them, and billions of dollars for the U.S. economy. But scientists warn very little is known about how much pollution it's causing. We begin our series in one of the nation's biggest gas hotspots, the vast Marcellus Shale that runs through western Pennsylvania. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on the struggle to prevent the region's water from being polluted by the gas industry.
Water is a big deal in Pennsylvania. It's got great trout streams, beautiful rivers, but industry has ruined a lot of Pennsylvania's water. Coal companies hammered this place. Mining left behind acidic water that's killed thousands of miles of streams. I stood on a bridge over a patch of the Lackawanna River, and every rock I could see was bright orange. And now Pennsylvanians fear a new toxic legacy, this time from shale gas. David Yoxheimer is a hydrologist at Penn State University.
Are we going to let this happen to Pennsylvania again? Are we going to make sure that we have enough money and that these companies' feet are held to the fire to make sure that once their operations are done, they put everything back together, tidy it up, and make it look like nothing happened there in the first place?
New gas drilling companies in the state want Pennsylvania's water to bust open shale. That means, first of all, water trucks. Everybody complains about these, even people in the industry. I visited a truck staging area run by Chesapeake Energy, and I talked to
Dan Lopata, L-O-P-A-T-A.
And you're in charge of water?
I'm the field superintendent with Chesapeake, in charge of all of our water infrastructure, that's correct.
For the whole Marcellus?
For the whole Marcellus.
It's a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, a lot of trucks. The transportation of all the fluids is probably our biggest expense, and that's our highest exposure to the local community. That's what they see driving up and down the road are the trucks.
And that's what they're annoyed with.
I would say yes to that question.
The water trucks roll up to a Chesapeake frack site, a drilling pad about half the size of a football field on a leveled hilltop. There's machinery and workers everywhere, all surrounded by forest, deer in the woods and John Deere on the pad. Workers here drill about a mile down, then out sideways into a layer of shale that holds natural gas. They detonate charges to crack the shale. Then they pump millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals down at high pressure to pry open those cracks and release the gas. When the gas comes to the surface, it brings up a lot of that water, and it's pretty nasty. Brian Grove is a Chesapeake senior director. He explains that the water has been exposed to what was once a seabed.
When you expose fresh water to it, that water absorbs the salts. That is something that you don't want to spill on the surface.
Besides salt, the water picks up minerals from the shale, some of them toxic, some radioactive. About a third of that polluted brine comes right back up, but more salty liquid will spew out of the well over a period of years. This wastewater is what makes people really twitchy. That's because industry used to dump the water straight into rivers, and pools holding the waste sometimes leaked. Brian Grove says the industry should have warned people how messy fracking is.
I think the biggest mistake the industry made early on in Marcellus development was just remaining silent. I think the industry as a whole has for 50, 60 years operated largely in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. The folks that moved east were people that were not used to having to explain themselves. They were used to being understood.
But explaining what fracking looks like may not have satisfied people in the face of this onslaught. Over 5,000 new wells just since 2008 in the Marcellus Shale, and there have been close to 700 violations involving water. And those violations have cost the industry a little over $1.5 million. So, under a lot of public pressure, the State Department of Environmental Protection has cracked down. They said no more dumping frack water straight into rivers. So some companies ran it through public water treatment plants. But the state stopped that, too. It came out too salty and too dirty. So the industry was forced to find another way to deal with frack water. And that's how the recycling business got started. Eureka Resources in Weemsport is an old brick factory next to the Susquehanna River. I put on a hard hat and went into the plant to talk with owner Dan Ertel about this recycling business.
Oh, I can smell that.
This flowback water. This is where all the flowback and produced water comes.
When Eureka started in 2008, the state wasn't ready for all this frack water from the wells.
We saw an absolute lack of any water treatment businesses or companies here.
So Eureka modified off-the-shelf technology to clean up this peculiar mix of gunk in frack wastewater. There's solid material like dirt, minerals like calcium, barium, sulfur compounds, and other pollutants. Then drillers take the cleaned up water back and use it again to break shale in a new well. All of this is an improvement, but at some point companies will stop drilling new wells and leave. And the state will have to find a way to get rid of the wastewater that's left behind. And in the meantime, there will be more spills. They tend to take place out of sight, in places people don't go to, a frack site out in the woods or on a deserted country road. And people worry about what they can't see. So there are scientists who are out there trying to see for them. I met hydrologist Andrew Gavin at a very nice trout stream called Gray's Run. He works for the Susquehanna Basin River Commission. We pulled on some waders, and Gavin explained what he was up to.
What we're doing in this monitoring project is really establishing what the general health of is the stream so that then we can measure, you know, if there are any changes to the quality of the water.
Scientists have to know the chemistry of a clean stream now so they'll know if frack water gets into one.
And just keep going until you fill up the sampling container.
The commission Gavin works for has planted battery-powered monitors in over 50 streams. If something unusual gets in the stream, their computers in Harrisburg alert them. So overall, there's been improvement in the way frack water is handled. But scientists say they need to be vigilant. Frack water chemistry, for example, can be surprising. I heard that from a water engineer, Jean Van Briesen, at Carnegie Mellon University.
We're not omniscient. We can't see everything. And sometimes there are downstream effects, particularly ones that involve the way systems interact with each other.
In fact, that happened in Pennsylvania. Bromide in frack water reacted with disinfectants at water treatment plants and created new compounds that could be hazardous to people's health. Van Briesen says she also wonders about what happens to all the frack water that's left underground. Pennsylvania is a pincushion. Oil and gas drilling has gone on for over a century here. She worries that frack water could seep up to the surface.
There are lots of holes in Pennsylvania. Knowing where the old wells are is very important when you're putting in a new one.
And people don't know where all those old wells are. Pennsylvania's struggle with this new industry is being repeated in other states where there is gas-bearing rock. Penn State's David Yoxheimer, the hydrologist who follows the frack water, says this issue has really galvanized people.
The natural gas industry and fracking has sort of been a lightning rod for America's environmental consciousness.
And although each state with natural gas is unique, one thing is common to all of them, the need for water. Lots of it. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Our series on America's fracking boom continues tomorrow on Morning Edition. We'll hear from sick patients living near gas wells in Pennsylvania and from the doctors who are searching for answers.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. J.P. Morgan Chase has long had the reputation of being one of the better managed big banks in the country. So how did it make a $2 billion blunder? And what does it tell us about banking today, nearly 5 years after the onset of the financial crisis? When such questions are looming, we often turn to David Wessel, economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. And David, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with what I suppose is seemingly a basic question. What exactly was J.P. Morgan trying to do with this financial maneuver that went wrong?
Well, that's something that the bank's chief executive, Jamie Dimon, has been trying to explain. He did it on Meet the Press on Sunday, and he surely will try again today when they have the company's annual shareholder meeting in Tampa, Florida. As he tells it, J.P. Morgan Chase is in the business of making loans and investing in securities, buying corporate bonds. To reduce their risks, it hedges. And hedges means you kind of take out insurance to, in case your borrowers don't pay back their loans. And in this case, they took out insurance. They thought they took out too much insurance, so they tried to offset that by selling some insurance. That's what they were trying to do. Now, why would a bank do this? Well, Mr. Dimon and other bankers say that in order to manage the risk of their portfolio, in order to make their business less risky, they do this hedging, and that allows them to make more loans, more car loans, more credit card loans, more job-creating business loans and stuff like that. Unfortunately, it didn't work out as they'd planned.
I mean, this seems pretty astounding. You keep using terms like hedge and reduce risk, and they're basically arguing that an effort to reduce risk loses $2 billion. I mean, is everyone buying this explanation?
No. And especially from the outside, it's incredibly hard to tell the difference between a hedge, where you're offsetting some risks you take in your business, and simply going to the casino and making a bet in the hopes of making a profit. And there are a lot of people outside J.P. Morgan who said, look, that's what they were doing. In fact, some people who used to work at J.P. Morgan have been saying that's what they were doing. Yes, they were running a little insurance business to protect their banking business, but on the side, they were trying to make what they call icing, some profits on the side. And the critics of current banking practices say, look, if people want to hedge, if they want to go and speculate in the market, that's fine. But the people who do that shouldn't be in the business of running a bank that has government-guaranteed deposits. You shouldn't mess up these two businesses.
Even bringing up the word casino as a comparison for a bank is probably something no one ever wants to hear.
Right, especially Jamie Dimon.
Well, can you just give us a window into a sophisticated bank like this? I mean, you have this image of a place with very smart experts and all these, you know, safety precautions in place. How could this happen?
Well, that's what's so scary here. So as you said at the beginning, J.P. Morgan Chase was supposed to be one of the best managed banks. It got through the financial crisis largely unharmed, and they managed to make a deal that was so complicated that its own senior management couldn't really understand it. Now, Mr. Dimon says, we're still going to earn a lot of money this quarter, so it isn't like the bank is jeopardized. And that, as far as we know, is true. But it did take 10% off its stock price, and it is raising the question about whether this bank and its peers are simply too big to manage. After all, if Jamie Dimon can't figure out what his London investment office is doing, who can? We worried a lot about banks during the crisis that we called too big to fail. That is, the government couldn't let them go under. It had to bail them out. But the result has been that banks are even bigger than they were before the crisis. And this too big to manage theme is really, really front and center now.
And David Wessel, really briefly, I mean, people who don't own, you know, stock in J.P. Morgan, I mean, you know, Americans out there, should they be worried about this, you know, becoming a larger problem?
Yes. One, it's a big mistake, and taxpayers pay if it gets to be a bigger mistake. So the question is this a warning sign that banks are back to their own shenanigans? And secondly, what happens at one bank usually doesn't happen only at one bank. All bank stocks are down on this. And the question is whether banks are doing things that will go kerblooey and put the economy at risk the way it was 4 or 5 years ago.
All right, David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal.
Let's go next to Canada, where real estate prices are soaring. It is now one of the hottest real estate markets in the world. In Canada's largest city, Toronto, home prices went up 10% in March alone. The average price for a house is over $600,000 there. Now, these numbers may be good for sellers, but they have experts worried that the country is in the midst of a housing bubble that is about to burst. Anita Elash has more.
So here's our little house.
40-year-old Jeff Douglas says he knows there are more responsible things to do than take on a mortgage he'll be paying until he turns 70. But he and his wife did it anyway when they bought a 1,300-square-foot duplex in Toronto's West End last month.
Bedrooms are not big.
The house, which he's showing off on a real estate website, is pretty basic. Three small bedrooms, two bathrooms, and a partially finished basement. Douglas paid $632,000. That's $76,000 more than the owner was asking for it. But in Toronto's hot real estate market, paying more than the asking price is par for the course. And Douglas thinks he got a bargain.
It was kind of one of the last houses I think that we would have had a shot at, because the price of the housing goes up every week, you know, as the spring goes on. So we thought this might be our last chance.
Canadian real estate prices did drop during the financial crisis, but they started increasing after a few months and haven't stopped since.
They've set it up so they're taking offers on Tuesday.
Real estate agent Brendan Powell says bidding wars are the norm in many Toronto neighborhoods, even for tiny homes like this 14-foot-wide row house.
Last year, we were seeing bidding wars that went up to $100,000 over, and that was a really big deal. Now we've actually seen a handful that were more than that, maybe twice that, which is insanity.
Powell's partner, Melanie Pichet, says record low interest rates are fueling the insanity. To keep the economy going, the Bank of Canada has held its prime lending rate at 1%. This winter, banks were offering mortgages for less than 3%, making house prices more affordable for many buyers.
For every extra $50,000, they're only looking at another $200 in mortgage a month, or $210 or $220 at the current rates. And those numbers are manageable for a lot of people. So suddenly you can get the house that you want for an extra $220 a month. Go for it. And now you've just paid $50,000 more than what you were planning on paying.
Powell and Pichet don't believe the Canadian real estate market will crash the way the U.S. market did. Canadian banks have stricter lending rules, and they're not allowed to give mortgages to people with no job or income. But analyst Ben Rabideau is one of many experts who believe house-crazy Canadians are spending themselves into financial disaster.
All of the models scream to me that we're looking at house prices nationally that are overvalued on the order of 30%, at least.
To buy their homes, Canadians have built up more debt than ever. Most can afford it as long as interest rates stay low. But the government has warned rates could start going up soon. When that happens, some studies show that at least 1 million Canadians will be in over their heads. Rabideau predicts people will stop spending, house prices will fall, and the economy will fall into a deep recession. Jeff Douglas is a radio host with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He says he knows there's a risk, but he's willing to live with it.
We made a choice based as much on quality of life as the actual quality of the investment. If it goes down, it goes down. And you sell at a loss. I mean, like people, it happens on the stock market all the time.
Despite his upbeat outlook, Douglas says he's stopped buying coffee at Starbucks and cut back on nachos and beer nights to help pay his mortgage. For NPR News, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Every week, as part of the new tech segment, we'll dig into our digital sandbox for some fun. It may be a game, advice about how to behave in the internet age, or today's review of a popular app called Draw Something. It's like Pictionary. Players pick a word, draw clues, and then watch as their opponents guess the answer. We asked someone with artistic prowess to give it a try.
Yeah, the first thing I was supposed to draw was a peanut.
That's New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie.
And it looked like someone had stepped in melted cheese.
As we'll hear in Diffie's review, the app's name is a little bit misleading.
Okay, so first of all, I think the name Draw Something isn't entirely accurate. It'd be more accurate to call it Scrawl Something, because that's what I did. Or maybe Draw Something with Your Foot while bull riding on a boat. I mean, you know, I don't know if I have big fingers or not, but I'm playing it on a phone rather than an iPad, so it's just like It's like getting to drive a Ferrari on a racquetball court. It's just frustrating. You're like, oh, come on. And it's not very responsive. You know, like, I know how to draw well. And so in my mind, I'm making all these intricate little finger moves. And I'm drawing, you know, in my mind, I'm drawing like a Rembrandt. But what's on the screen looks more like the work of Jimmy the Painting Chimp. To sum it all up, I sat down there for like, I thought 20 minutes, and suddenly I've been on there an hour. So to that level, it was very successful in like passing the time and being entertained. And as soon as I let go of the idea of it being like a drawing tool and embraced it as being a game, then it was wonderful. I'm one of those guys, even in cartooning, I tend to draw things better than they need to be. And it's really fun to just sort of relax and just draw something badly.
That's New Yorker cartoonist Matthew Diffie, and if you'd like to see some of his sketches, perhaps his Draw Something rendition of John Travolta, or give a review of your own favorite drawing app, visit our website at npr.org. Next week, we'll introduce another new piece of our all-tech segment, a social media advice column. So please email your tech comments and questions to alltech@npr.org.